Eastern Panhandle, and Romney, when I was about 12, and then we moved to Greenbelt County, where my mom was from, and I was in the ninth grade, and my grandmother, my aunt, my cousins, and all lived there. So I was there until I went to college, went to WVU, and I graduated from there in 75, and have pretty much lived in Morgan County area since then.
Jenny Bardwell, born in 1954, soon to be 63, and I grew up in upstate New York country, and then came to Missouri, and my husband got a job with the U.S. Forest Service in Morgantown, West Virginia. So we've lived here almost 30 years. I went to Culinary Institute in 1976 in Hyde Park, New York, and had a bakery in Massachusetts for a few years, sold it, went to college at University of Massachusetts, and got a master's in plant pathology, and then came down to this area of Morgantown, West Virginia, Mount Morris, Pennsylvania, and had the bakery here for the last 7 years.
Could you tell us about your first experience with Fort Rice and Bread?
With eating it or making it? Well, I have to say that it goes back to when I was a child, because my grandmother made it, and that's how I love it. And I have memories of her making the bread, saying it was starter, where she would put it, and everyone would ask her, you know, actually next morning, did the starter come? Are we going to have bread today? And also, I write in the book about one of the favorite memories I have of being at home. We used to go to grandmother's house on Saturday mornings and just be her and me. And she would make eggs and easy bacon and her salt rice and bread. And it's just a wonderful memory of that. So that's the beginning of my association with salt rice and bread.
When we moved here to Mount Morris, we went to a small local church, which was basically the Haynes family in that church, and us. And and they were wonderful friends. We became wonderful friends, and they taught us all kinds of survival tactics in the countryside. And one day I was going up to Pearl Haynes' house, and they were making soap from lye. And there was a big cauldron on the hillside, and they were boiling lye and making soap. And it was fall, and it was up on the hillside, and the leaves were beautiful colors swirling around. And then afterwards, we went inside and ate, and I had salt rice and bread for the first time, and I just fell in love with it. And Pearl taught me how to make it from then on. That's how I learned about salt rice.
Well, trial and error. I didn't really. I think I may have tried it a couple times when I was a teenager at home, but I didn't stick with it too much. Although looking back, I should have, because grandmother was right there. But anyway, I started trying it again after I was married and had young children, and grandmother was still living then, so I could call her. And she was down in the entire state, and I was up here, but I would call her and she would give me advice and give me recipes and stuff like that. But like I said last night, I don't remember really perfecting it until after she died, when I really got more serious about it.
Individuals that you found knew how to do, but you couldn't go to the store and buy it.
Yeah, there were a few Kroger's, like the Elkins, I remember when we first moved here. I could buy frozen salt rice and bread. So that was like 1990. But then that disappeared. And I think as Susan said last night, it was due to the salt rice and yeast that commercial bakers kind of used up their stores, and there just wasn't any of them anymore. So then those stores gradually didn't have a viable way of making it. They didn't think they could make it.
prove them on.
I think as a child, I don't remember ever getting salt rising bread anywhere except from this woman's kitchen. But then when I did come to Morgantown, I remember at one point there was a big jar of bread. I can't remember who made that.
It might have been the Home Industries in Clarksville. They sold it probably until they used up their salt rising needs.
And I've only heard about them from pepperoni rolls because it used to be that they would allow women to come and then they would market their own bakeries.
Maybe. I don't know the history of the people there. I don't know if they have new owners now. I've been in contact a little bit to see if they wanted to buy our salt rising bread because they still have a whole line of stores that they sell the pepperoni rolls to. But they haven't taken it back.
Why does it compel you?
Well, I find it compelling because it's mysterious and it's a challenge. Those two aspects are just wonderful ways to get involved and be passionate about something in life, something that's mysterious and challenging. And it tastes good.
I agree with everything Jane said, but I feel like also for me, this whole idea of salt rising bread is compelling because it reaches such deep and sweet memories in people. And I think whenever you can find that somewhere in life, it's nice to find that and to talk about it. And so that's one of the things I really like about salt rising bread. Being involved in it. But of course, I'm also compelled because that is my thing.
Maybe we can just what we were talking about how it seems to come a community together. I mean, people walk in this morning, and legs are spread, and people, this is a destination.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So there's some sort of a touchstone of memory and culture.
Yeah, when we, on my website, and since we opened the bakery and people would talk to us when they called over the bread, we always, when I was here, I would ask them, what's your connection to living? People love to talk about their stories and their memories and their connection to salt rising bread. And I'm sure that's true of other foods too, but this is the one that we know about. And,
I bet if you can't ask that guy this morning, who made it when you were young, he would have been glad to tell us.
Yeah.
Your grandmother. As soon as he said, I asked him where he was from, he said, Cape Salome. And that's an area, I don't know, 5 miles over the mountains here into West Virginia and borders on Fairview area, which is
the largest town
of the world. Yeah, of the world.
Of the world, yeah.
Why is it? It's like everybody there either knows how to make it or knows someone who makes it. Everyone knows, and it's a small community. They had a school there, they raised money for a library. Somehow that community has been able to kind of stay coherent as a community. And I'm not really sure why. I don't know the history of Fairview, but it was probably more prosperous 50 years ago than it is now.
Yeah.
And I don't know the full history. It's coal mining in there. We still have a small school.
It's also compelling when someone says to you,
took over engineering ideas.
And particularly integrated UI.
Yeah.
You were talking about providing something.
Yeah.
And the woman had to provide a meal.
Right. Right.
And they used that technology.
Right.
At the time.
Using that salt barrel on the
yeah.
side of the wagon.
That's about it.
Yeah. Really interesting idea. So, I don't know, I'm just kind of trying to take that idea to 2017 now. It's just really valuable to keep that tradition alive. Because I think, see, in a way, so the men took, why do you have to go that? Men, here we go. And the men kind of took this yeast and then it got lost. The art of making that yeast got lost. And we don't need it. So we don't feel the need to keep that technology going. But we want to keep the tradition of soul rising bread alive, or otherwise it would get lost too.
And sometimes it is important to have. I mean, the fact that you have a bakery here where people can come and have it. I mean, it doesn't, sometimes it's important to have an in public and be
able to. Yeah. We're still making it the way the women did.
Right.
Another thing I wanted to ask, I think one of you mentioned yesterday that most of the people who come and buy are older.
Yep. Yep.
And so have you given time? I'm sure you have. To how the tradition is going to progress in
yeah.
20 years from
yeah.
now.
Yeah. Yeah. That's our whole reason for doing all this work. You know, to keep the tradition going, to keep
yeah.
the younger people to like it, introduce it to them, so that some of them hopefully will want to learn to make it. Because otherwise it will go away.
Mm.
I think we are the main movers and shakers in this movement of trying to keep this tradition going.
Or just that people are going to take it home.
Well, our classes, certainly, but we do need to appeal to younger people. As I get you here, I mean, we want to make another video. We have one video on the web that's kind of amateur, and people love it.
Yeah.
But we want to do another video that is a little more in depth and captures some of the tricks and skills and making salt rising bread. And then there's this apprenticeship program. I mean, maybe we should think of that apprenticeship program in terms of really capturing the interest of younger people.
Yeah.
The problem is that times are different now than they were when all these were made back in the 50s, 40s, 30s.
And women are more of the workforce, obviously, and they don't have time at home. They're not at home that much. And so it's not just having to reach the younger generation, but it's you have to find a way that the younger generation can actually make this a part of their lives. Even if they want to, they may not be able to because of the lifestyle.
Yeah.
It's a funny thing. I think they recognize that one thing I learned from the workshop I saw is salt raising bread is a product of time and temperature.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's a good thing. So it's time, and it's a good thing. And I think I agree with what you're saying. People don't have the time or don't want to give up that time.
We are in a moment now when a lot of those things are coming back to canyon, for instance, and have this moment where the male people are going to be able to get the fact that she writes it up, hits the canyon.
I was
over walking, so I saw all the big trees.
Right.
So back to the land. The nice thing about salt raisin bread is you don't need anything that you might not have. Okay, flour. And like Susan said, you can make starters with flour and water. You can use some potatoes, they're pretty common, cornmeal, some other ground bean like garbanzo flour, and baking soda. So there's a pretty common ingredient. So if you don't happen to have any yeast
tonight, you can make risen bread.
Was the cornmeal milk.
Mm-hmm. That's the one.
Could you tell us about Pearl?
Oh, she was a wonderful, passionate person. She was a great storyteller and historian in her own right. We interviewed her probably 5-6 times, and it was the last time that Susan asked, did you ever hear of Sal or Adder? And so we could listen. I've known Pearl like 20-some years, and that one question was the first time she ever mentioned, oh, yeah, Volturatus, which is, and she said, my mother used to talk about Volturatus.
No, it was like, God,
oh,
oh
my
God,
God,
this is a real big moment.
So luckily we asked the right question.
Yeah,
he died within months after that. That's the only person I've talked to who knew Sal Aratus, Volturatus. There's a book out there. There's a couple books. There's one called Sal Aratus. It's cited in our book. But we got a lot of history about Sal Aratus from. There's also the Headley book written about some food ways in Pennsylvania, West Virginia. And their book is pretty detailed. They talk about Sal Aratus, and they talk about how in Clarksburg it was pronounced one way, and in Morgantown it was pronounced another way, and in Wheeling it was pronounced another way. So I thought that was interesting, because here was Pearl kind of documenting to us a whole other way of saying Salarat, salt, the way that
it's the way that's
right. Well, originally one of the first recipes we have for salt rising bread is using potash instead of baking soda. We didn't have baking soda. This is late 1700s. So potash was this rough kind of food that you made by pouring water over your wood ashes and then letting it evaporate, so you had this kind of white powdery mixture, and it basically lie as an alkaline. Yeah, exactly. And Razor biscuits, the gingerbread, and now that's something I'm really interested in pursuing, to see if it was the pioneer women that started using potash to raise their biscuits and gingerbread, and then that knowledge was then taken over the ocean to Europe, or was it knowledge, excuse me, that was brought here, because the earliest cookbooks have it in, like Amelia Simmons, her 1790 cookbook, talks about using potash for biscuits and gingerbread, not salt rising bread. We found a separate recipe for that. But it isn't in Europe in cookbooks until 1800s that they talk about using potash. Potash was used for glass making, so it had been used for thousands of years, but not in food. And so I'm in the process of contacting some Rachel Lauden, who's a food historian. And I also contacted Rosemary Hathaway for the year. About the potash history. So I'm really curious. I think it would be really cool to document that it was the pioneer women who started using potash for raising biscuits and things.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting.
So once potash got used for baking and glass making in Europe, we're talking about early 1800s, you know, populations are rising, and they need more and more windows for houses, so forests were being depleted, and they, and industrialization was coming into being, so they invented their own potash. They made a form of sodium bicarbonate, and I don't know what it was called in Europe. But then that knowledge of
States, and they started industrially producing it here, and they called it Sour Olive. And then all up into the 1800s, people used it for baking, and it was a much more consistent, uniform product than potash, which just depending on how much water it ran through. And then I think it was 1900, baking soda was placed there. I think early 1900s. Well, they found saleratus, which is was naturally formed from salt kind of deposits, but that's mostly out west. I don't think you can find it here. And I don't know the complete history of that, if the women kind of discovered it or they kind of just knew it because of saleratus already thought being able to buy it. I don't know that for history. But it's interesting. I'm really anxious to find out if it was the pioneer women that started using potash for baking, and then gave that knowledge to the Europeans.
I know that we went through this yesterday, but for the cake, could you walk us through the process of making the bread?
Well, there are three stages involved in making salt rising bread. First is the starter, the second is the sponge, and the third is the dough. The starter is made with basically two basic recipes. One, we use potatoes and boiling water, the other is cinnamon milk. You put that together and set it in a warm place for about 12 hours, usually overnight. And the next morning, when that is fermented and it's foamy and has a good smell, you pour out the water or the fermentation from the potatoes, discard them, and add a little bit of water and flour. Or if it's a corner starter, you just add flour and water and mix it up. So it's about the consistency of a pancake batter. And you set that again in the warm place for, it generally takes 1.5 to 2 hours, maybe 1 to 2 hours. So that doubles in size. And then you just add water and flour and mix up the dough. And you put it in the pan and the dough rises and then you bake them. That must be slow, isn't it?
And how long do you bake?
I usually bake mine about 25 minutes, but that
usually.
Mm-hmm. It varies from recipe to recipe. Basically, you just want to bake them until it's a golden brown and highly in the take that long to bake.
Can you describe the, what it looks like, what it tastes like?
We always say that the characteristic look of salt raisin bread is a flat top. And that if you see a domed top, it's not real salt raisin bread. The taste, we often say it has a cheese-like flavor. And it's not salty. This is what my taste is.
I could add a little bit to that. With salt rising bread, it's primarily hydrogen gas that's rising the bread. And that's something Dr. Coleman back in 1909 was studying. So the bacteria in salt rising bread use primarily hydrogen. It's a lighter gas than carbon dioxide, which is what yeast produces. So yeast breads tend to rise up higher, and salt rising bread then, like Susan said, has that flat top and a tender crumb. I think the hydrogen gas, for some reason, makes the crumb appear more white and very small air holes.
It's gentle, that hydrogen gas. I think that's why it makes a good toast. Because it's a dense bread, heavy
bread.
Well, baking soda, which is a type of chemist salt. Saleratus, it's a type of salt, sodium bicarbonate, potassium bicarbonate. So that's why we've seen one main theory for the salt rising bread. The second theory is that it was the starter and sponge and dough made them kind of coddled with blocks of rock salt around it. Or as the westward migration people talked about when they were in the wagon trains, they would put their starter in a barrel of rock salt to keep it warm. And that held the heat with the sun shining on it all day. Held the heat so that it would ferment at the right temperature.
I think so also. That just makes more sense to me. I mean, I can see why someone might say, oh, it was called salt rising bread because of the salt, you know. But I think the first theory is that we kind of can't believe.
But what about those recipes that don't have any salt in them? Is there any recipe that doesn't have even salt when you start it?
They started as saleratus, saltarized bread, and then people changed the recipe over the years. And they maybe went to make it one time and it didn't have salt when they started, so they just used flour and water. Obviously, the recipes vary a lot with those things. But also, I recently read an article all about a bread that was called Allegheny bread, and it's salt rising bread, C-A-E-T. And I had never seen it. Did I tell you that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's got me thinking, well, so why did it become Allegheny bread? Why did it become Allegheny bread?
And this is from Pennsylvania.
Well, the woman was raised, right, I think, in this area. She said, the article said she was raised in Pennsylvania, just on the border of West Virginia. And so Pennsylvania is part of Pennsylvania, and she lived here, and she called it Allegheny bread. So I don't know if, I mean, the Allegheny's not here, so maybe she had relatives who lived here, out of here, and they called it Allegheny bread. I don't know, but we haven't pursued that yet.
How long was that with
her? Well, I think about 3 years ago.
Oh,
great. And then something she made a
No, she just made it at home, but her son was the artisan, and so my mom made Allegheny bread, and he gave it up to me at the garden. Well, people say salt rising, salt risen. Not much.
There's something lightning bread. We read about lightning bread, but it wasn't exactly salt rising.
Yeah.
It was kind of precursor, maybe to salt rising.
I can't forget what that was.
Or, if you, like, the early cookbooks where they, a lot of times we come across this early recipe where you take a vessel and you scald the vessel. How do you scald a vessel? By putting in a pot of scalding water. So you're kind of sterilizing it, and then you put your midlings in, and then you add water, and midlings back then mean cornmeal. And I don't remember the recipe that they added baking soda or potash. I have to look at them again. And then within 5 hours, it will rise up, and we're like, whoa, I've never seen a salt rising bread started. Rose up in 5 hours, but
we've seen several recipes in research where they say 5 hours, and we thought for a long time, well, that had to be Mexican or something, but that's not possible. But then, you know, at that point, this was hundreds of years ago, 200 years ago, maybe the flour was different, or the, you know, it was, and so the I have been some reason because we've seen it several times, only 5 hours. But we've never really been exactly why it works in 5 hours. If it won't now, I mean, we can get a million times.
I'm talking about how to use the energy
that we both lived in that north and Jenny and I hadn't met. So we met through our friend, and we both had young children at the time, so we were both in Mount Morris, we had young kids, and so we obviously liked each other enough to spend time together. All the years, we just lived there for all that time. I didn't visit very much. Yeah, so it was really something to kind of share, and we helped each other in perfecting it and making it, and the whole mystery of it. I think we really kind of both loved investigating.
Yeah.
Susan had her past, and I don't know, maybe I had the client kind of background.
Well, that's what I feel like, you know.
Yeah.
The stories that were sent in by email, but in a way they weren't orally passed, but they were passed to me beginning before we really had the bakery and before we started going out and interviewing women. I was collecting stories from the internet and the website, and then we worked with WVU Extension for a while in the 90s. And she, Patty Kissing, was the director there, and she helped us, she let us use her mailing list for all the women in West Virginia who were in these little extension home clubs. And we sent a letter.
And that's like almost every county in the state.
It was every county, yeah. So she let us compose a letter that was signed by her and, with our input. These women are looking to research salt rice and bread. Do you have a recipe you'd like to share? And so, in the course of them sending the recipes, almost everyone had to say something about mm-hmm. about the recipe or about the bread. So we got a lot of really nice stories along with those recipes. Some just heart-wrenching and beautiful. And so we got those. And then I guess we just started interviewing people when we were beginning to think about writing a book. And I just feel like I've been talking to people about salt rice and bread all my life, basically, as long as I can remember that.
So it was the extension project, and then the bakery, and then in the early years of the bakery, we sent a survey out, asking again for stories and anything you know about salt rice.
And it had 5 questions on the survey. And it was also in my book. It was really a fun thing to do. It was so great to get them back and see what people say.
From all over the country.
Yeah.
A lot from California and Florida. And that's where we came up with, of 100 surveys, we had 5 people under the age of 60. Mm-hmm. that's the demographic we're really
in. That's so funny.
We asked people also in the survey what's their favorite way to eat it. And by far, toast with butter was right up there.
We asked them who did they learn to make it from, or how did they come to have it in their lives. And it was almost always grandmother made it, or my great aunt made it. It was a family thing. Although there were several who grew up getting it from those bakeries in California a lot of times. But even though they went to bakery did it, they still had memories. They said, every Saturday morning, my dad would go and take us to the bakery and get salt rice and bread and come back and sit around the table and always taste together.
Playing in this community.
respect in the people who come to buy the bread. It's like, we appreciate that. So this is something that was poor community, poor rural community. They had this, and now someone's appreciating it, and they can continue those memories by coming and buying the bread. It's pretty cool. It feels really wonderful that you have to do that. It's not only this community that's impacted by it, but I mean, this is all over the country. Mm-hmm. Like, once in a while, I'll get people, they buy the bread, and it just wasn't stinky enough. I can't believe you sell that. You call it salt rising bread. Oh, you know, you can't please everybody.
We have this theory that if people age, you know, they're such a kid. It's not as acute. And we don't see that again, but we feel like, you know, it is that good taste, and it does smell of family, but they don't know, you know, they don't realize that they're not trying to taste it.
Acknowledged and appreciated.
Although I was saying last night that I think that it's important not to elevate salt, rice, and bread to a point that it's not true to what it really is. I mean, it was the people's bread. And that's grand enough. And I have a little bit of a problem with making it, fancifying it, losing the real history and meaning behind it. Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. just won't come by that day.
And you never know what if you put something out there in the world, what how can you do it? What they're going to do with it. But I think the way that you approach what to read about the story as part of it, you know, intertwining the story.
About rap music. I mean, you look at the play Hamilton, I don't know if you looked at the musical score for Hamilton, but it's hip hop.
Mm-hmm.
And it's now Broadway.
Yeah.
And you're $1,000 for a ticket to go see it.
Yeah. Yeah.
A little bit more like where Susan is coming from. So you're saying you don't want to lose this history or this idea of importance of memory and sitting around the kitchen table eating salt rising bread. Or what is it that you're not wanting to get away from?
I guess it's kind of like I feel like it would be unkind to the women who've made this so laboriously for so many years for their friends and their families and their loved ones to have it become like a high-end specialty kind of food.
And it was a bread they had to make to survive. And so therefore, to put it really high up on a pedestal and fancy it up, I think it's doing an injustice and a disservice to all these women, for all these years who
put so away
hard work in
human.
Because
you're talking about very human, basic human values.
Yeah. Like you said, it's a walking fine line because we part of what we want to do is have it available to more people, have other people enjoy it and carry it on. And
yeah.
But how far does that go? You're growing the food,
right.
You're caring about harvesting it, eating your
local food.
I talk to my kids about how to plan food because I personally worry about the future. Like, they may have to grow their own food someday and plan it. You don't know.
I think it's very important.
your little tiny thing of, you know, raspberry jelly or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
It's just, you're so special to people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But
so,
we had the only Asian who's ever made fault lines.
No,
we should have published that. I'm sorry, I shouldn't say that. It's not really nice, but it's really good then.
Yeah. No, we talked about actually trying to clean out selling the bakery.
Right, at Farmer Market.
And making plans for
to me, ideally, if a couple could buy it, just because I'm getting older and hard work, and if a couple could buy it, then they could leave two tables and continue this tradition. It would be wonderful. It's a good little business, and it's a wonderful product. So I can do. Sure. Oh, yeah. I'd be glad to work with it. I would
need it.
No. I'll take your job and just take any stuff. I've always wanted your job.
I think you're probably the one who's doing it. How many people did you actually interview? You have a number of, I can't remember,
20-some little books. Yeah, we didn't put all of them in the book. Recorded it and then transcribed.
Yeah.
So we have the original transcript. Yeah. Yeah, it's a great way to kind of go over the interview again. And you're typing away. It's always yeah, but you know how when you document something with your hand, your mind is changed. Some people in Fairview you could go see. Since our book is finished, we're finding all these other people to interview, but that is always going to happen,
that's
I
right.
think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We find a couple more states in the book that we could.
We know just the archiving of the interview. And we have them digitized?
Yeah. I mean, I could hand them to you.
And you're
glad to.
We're working out the I can see one more
Yeah, I mean, these people who may call that and better no, we haven't. We certainly handed out books to all the but no, that's a nice idea. I didn't keep the tape recording. I just didn't have fancy equipment, so I had to kind of keep overriding it.
I have some of the recordings that I've made,
and I did send transcripts of some of the interviews. wood bakery was open, so her mother loved salt rising bread, but she was sick, and so she didn't make it, and she was on my website, so she said, I can't find it anywhere, so I said, well, I'll make some and send it to you. So I did, and she was just really grateful, and I sent it to her a few times, and in the bakery, I think she just started buying it from the bakery, and she would give us a little update on her mother each time, and that's the one for where the only thing her mother could eat was the salt rice and bread. That's the only thing she wanted to keep dying. And then eventually she had an email saying, Mom died last night. She could no longer eat the salt rice and bread, but it was a great comfort to me and my sister. And things like that.
Yeah.
And it's just
mostly women, but they definitely, guys also, they've tried making salt rice and bread for years and haven't got it to work, but hopefully we've helped them with the, and I think as Mary said, it's time and temperature. You know, knowing to recognize when the starter's ready, not getting it too soon. But that seems to be more an error than on the other end. It seems like you can let the starter go a pretty long time and it'll work. Getting it when it's not smelly enough. I mean, I can recognize the smell now. So we're kind of helping people get in touch with what it looks like, the smell, the temperature, the importance of keeping that warm temperature.
We've even had people come to the class who don't live around here, who, you know, have bought the bread through the bakery or seen the website and found out about the class, and they have drawn it.
Yeah, we have them in St. Louis and Michigan to take the class.
And now she's really a good friend of Jenny's. She was so cute. She had seen our video, and when she came, she just thought like we were Hollywood actresses or something. She was like, well, I can't believe I'm meeting Susan Brown and Jenny Barbell. She's so cute. Southwestern New York State also has a little area of size and great knowledge.
I once tried to look at the path of the railways and salt. Because there is salt from upstate New York and something like that in the rest of
the I think something back to what Jenny was saying about time and temperature, the other really important thing you have to have in making salt rice bread is patience. And you can't hurry along. That was Pearl's motto. You can't hurry it along. And that's true. And some women have tried to make salt rice and bread. Like, you know, one woman we interviewed would set her starter in the morning, work all day, and come home and make the sponge at the end of the day. And she was fairly successful at that. But the starters and the sponge are so fragile that you can miss it if you're not right there when it comes. You know, if the starter's ready and you're not there, it'll begin to deflate and then it won't work. The same way with the sponge. So you can try to do it when you're not home all day, but it's tricky because you really need to be watching it.
Because there's so many variables. If you try to control the environment, there's so many variables.
Dealing with wild mushrooms. And that's been an interesting thing too, because from a deacon is as we can find
those
moments of time. So I wonder if there's have you found people interested?
get the respect that it is worthy of in some ways, in a lot of ways. So I think that because we talk to, popular, well-known bread bakers, and I've always looked in bread books when I'm in that bookstore, and you rarely see Salizing Bread. And then when we have talked to, like that Peter Reinhardt, and some of those people, they seem like a little more interested in it, but some of the bakers just like to see it, like maybe I've heard of that, but they don't really want to pursue
it. There's a whole aspect of Salizing Bread that we haven't discussed. The bacteria, Clostridium perfringens, can be a pathogen. And when we were first discovering that it was a Clostridium bacteria that was rising the bread, we were at first alarmed because it can cause food poisoning, gangrene. There's different versions of Clostridium. Right, so, and here we are feeding our family. But there's no history of anybody ever getting sick eating salt rising bread, which is why we wrote that article with Dr. Greg Juckett and put documents out that it's been around hundreds of years. There's absolutely no evidence of anyone ever getting sick to do the raw salt or the sun. And no one ever gets sick. And it also at that point we found a pathologist at University of Pittsburgh, Dr. Bruce McLean, and he studied nothing but Clostridium perfringens, the pathogen. So he said, sure, bring some starters up there, because he just wanted to verify. And we brought a dozen starters, loaf of bread, and walked into his lab and smelled just like salt rising bread.
Yeah, that was so funny.
And he's like a world-renowned pathologist.
Yeah.
So he had his postdoc do PCR analysis on it, and they could not find the gene for the toxin in any of our starters, none of our bread, which was really revealing. So the gene wasn't even present. Mm-hmm. It's not that it wasn't even expected, it wasn't even present. And we put that in our article with Dr. Greg Juckett. So that was really interesting. Would he eat the bread?
I don't know. My husband won't eat the bread. He's a doctor. He's not from something wrong with that
because of the history. But since this bacteria is found in our gut as part of the natural microbiome, and if you look at many bacteria like anthrax, that causes if you look at anthrax that causes disease, the toxin in anthrax is not present, and I don't even think the gene is present in Bacillus thuringiensis, which is an insecticide that you put on your cabbage to prevent the cabbage moth from. They're both anthrax bacteria. And so many bacteria, I think scientists are really just beginning to understand the genetics of bacteria and the name that they're called. And so the fact that Clostridium perfringens is in salt rising bread and in our stomach is part of the natural microbiome. It probably doesn't.
Right.
That's good
the other thing
to say. There's probably a few spores.
Another study done by a scientist in the 60s, that Jack, I think was his name, and he said in his, clearly, no one has ever, we can document it, no one has ever died from eating salt rising bread. So
there was this weird study, I don't even remember it. Anyway, so I think that's one reason why some of these sourdough people, Bread Bakers Guild, I'm a member of Bread Bakers Guild, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it's kind of like the organization for artisan bread makers. And salt rising bread is really poo-pooed, and they don't like people. And they're really afraid that the salt rising bread is going to contaminate their sourdoughs that they've had for millennia.
That's the only kind of thing that they're not saying, which some of these
afraid of the prophecy. They're just afraid of. So it has gotten a little bit of a bad name, and hopefully word will spread. I taught classes at Dead Baker Guild classes to kind of promote this idea. You don't have to worry about it. But I'm the only one out there. Sometimes it's a little lonely, but
yeah,
it's okay.
I think it's back to that question about why it's not amongst the currently fermented people. It's in addition to that aspect, it is so powerful.